The reason why I'm beginning this class with the Timaeus and the Critias is simple. The Timaeus and Critias are almost entirely myths. They're just myths from beginning to end, and myths in the very specific sense as fanciful stories. They're dialogues, and they have a narrative structure, but most of what they contain are just simply long stories that are spun out in the first by Timaeus and the second by Critias. Now, that alone should recommend it, but there are other reasons for recommending these dialogues to start out studying the myths of Plato, and that's this. They're extremely fundamental myths, especially the one of the Timaeus, because it's a myth about the cosmos, the origin of the cosmos, and what better place to start than the very beginning, as the song goes. So what's the better place to start than the origin of the cosmos? Now, another thing that's very important about these dialogues, or these myths, is that the pair, I think, are a nice contrast. Because Plato is quite aware of the perils of myth. He's quite aware of the perils of traditional, non-philosophic myths. Yet at the same time, he's quite bullish, if you will, on philosophic myths. And the myth of the Timaeus is a paradigmatic, that's a model, philosophical myth. Whereas the myth of Atlantis, which begins at the beginning of the Timaeus and is told mostly in the Critias, is shown to be a kind of paradigmatic, traditional myth with lots of problems. And I think that the two are juxtaposed as a way of heightening the differences between traditional and philosophical myths. And I think that the strange characteristic of the Critias, namely that it breaks off in mid-sentence, I think that's deliberate. I don't think it was unfinished. J.N. Findlay, who's otherwise a responsible and actually a rather good scholar, speculates that Plato must have had a stroke and didn't finish the Critias. I think that's just preposterous, considering that he went on to write the Laws after this, which is a very long work and doesn't display any mental paralysis of any sort. And if he could have gone on to write the Laws, he certainly could have gone on to finish the Critias if it was his intent, right? I think it's purposeful that the dialogue breaks off in mid-sentence, and I think that the reason why it breaks off might have something to do with the recognition on the part of Critias about the nature of the kind of tale he's telling. And so I'll just throw that out as a kind of clue for interpreting it. I think that Critias breaks off because he has a kind of illumination experience here. Suddenly something hits him about the nature of the tale that he's telling. And what hits him, I think, is set up in the previous dialogue with the other tale. So that's my main reason for doing the Timaeus and Critias. In the Phaedo, Socrates, on the day of his death, tells a myth about the underworld, which is rather different from the stories that you get in the Republic or the Gorgias. And I just want to give you the beginning and the end of the story. I don't want to go through all the descriptions of all the underworld sewers and lakes and streams and stuff like that. Socrates says, "It is right to think, then, gentlemen, that if the soul is immortal, it requires our care." It's a hypothetical statement. "If it is immortal, it requires our care, not only for the time we call our life, but for the sake of all time, and that one is in terrible danger if one does not give it that care. If death were escaped from everything, it would be a great boon to the wicked to get rid of the body and of their wickedness together with their soul. But now that the soul appears to be immortal, there is no escape from evil or salvation for it except by becoming as good and wise as possible. For the soul goes to the underworld possessing nothing but its education and upbringing, which are said to bring the greatest benefit or harm to the dead right at the beginning of the journey yonder," namely of the judgment that you face as soon as you go yonder. In the Gorgias, Socrates uses this phrase, education and upbringing. Polus says, "What, Socrates, are you going to say that even the great king might not be happy, namely the Persian emperor, the most powerful man in the world?" And he says, "I can't say anything unless I know about his education and upbringing." Polus says, why? Does happiness depend entirely on these? And Socrates says, yes, entirely on this, education and upbringing. Now, he goes and he tells this long story about the underworld and the various lakes and rivers and punishments of the wicked, what happens to father beaters and things like that. And then he ends this way, and this is very telling. No sensible man would insist that these things are as I have described them. But I think it is fitting for a man to risk the belief, for the risk is a noble one, that this or something like this is true about our souls and their dwelling places, since the soul is evidently immortal, and a man should repeat this to himself as if it were an incantation, which is why I've been prolonging my tale. And the word there is muthon, tale, myth. That is the reason why a man should be of good cheer about his own soul if during life he has ignored the pleasures of the body and its ornamentation as of no concern to him and doing him more harm than good, but has seriously concerned himself with the pleasures of learning and adorned his soul not with alien but with its own ornaments, namely moderation, righteousness, courage, freedom, and truth, and in that state awaits his journey to the underworld. This is very telling. No sensible man would insist that these things are as I have described them. Well, he's a sensible man, and he recognizes that myths aren't literally true, and they are very easily destroyed if you treat them as literally true. Any sophist or natural philosopher can pick all kinds of holes in them and say that. They can say, well, you know, how can there be a first or a second or a third day of creation? Because there wouldn't be any days before the earth is created, right? Now you can start picking holes in these stories if you treat them literally. No sensible man would insist that these things are as I have described them, but I think it is fitting for a man to risk the belief. The word belief here is pistis, which is also translated as faith. Say the New Testament, the Greek word pistis is the word that's translated as faith. And there's a sense of risk here. Why is there a sense of risk? Because we don't know for sure, and therefore there's always going to be a chance that you're wrong, right? But he says, it's worth risking belief that something like this is true. Why? Because it's necessary to risk this belief if one is going to do the best one can in caring for one's soul in this life. Okay. So there's a kind of pragmatism here, a concern with self-cultivation that licenses one to take certain leaps of faith, if you will, or risks of belief, even when one recognizes that one can't know for sure that some things are true. But one can know, one can risk believing that something like this is true, which is a recognition that it's probably not 100% accurate, never could be. It would be foolish to expect that. So this is the Platonic attitude. It's very pragmatic about standards of truth and is very concerned with self-cultivation and self-improvement. Now the question is, does Plato believe it too? Plato has this notion of noble lies, right? And in the Republic, he's constantly saying that the guardian class in the Republic should be brought up believing certain things that are false. Like, for instance, that mating is determined by a lottery when actually it's determined by a eugenics program that the elite are running. And so it's clear that the elite don't believe certain stories that they tell people who are on the rung. And is Plato a cynic about this kind of stuff or not? Well, my sense is no, he's not. He's not a cynic about this. These aren't stories that he's telling to other people because he thinks it'll make them better people. These are the kinds of stories that he told himself. Now, there are many commentators who want to say, well, this is just some noble lie that Plato is telling because he wants to help poor schmucks who can't face the meaninglessness of life to delude themselves into thinking that there's a divine plan and that the world is just and nonsense like that. I think that's mistaking Plato for Nietzsche. And that's a big mistake to make. In fact, it's far harder to believe that Plato was as cynical as someone like Nietzsche about the order of the cosmos. It's far harder to believe that than it is to believe that he could believe these stories, I think. The arguments that many people make to the effect that Plato couldn't have believed this are premised on the assumption that no serious person could hold the views that I've just read aloud here. No serious person, no real philosopher could hold these views. Well, but the fact of the matter is that the history of philosophy is replete with examples of very serious philosophers who have held views just like this. Now, I guess one could say, well, they couldn't have been serious either. If you really want to stick with this view, if you look at the history of philosophy, you find that people like Pascal or Kant or Rousseau or William James have all held similar positions. And James's essay, The Will to Believe, is the most clear and lucid account, I think, of this basic position in the history of thought. But I think Plato is really the first pragmatist in James's sense, the first person who argues that we should risk believing things about stuff that we don't know if we find that the moral necessities of life, the necessities of self-cultivation, demand that we form beliefs about things that we can't have knowledge. Okay. So with that, let me just try and move us now into the Timaeus itself. Well, I think that's a really interesting issue. My view is this, because I've thought about this a lot. The Egyptians clearly had a scheme of the afterlife that's much more in keeping with the kinds of stories that Socrates tells than the kinds of stories that the other Greeks told. The most commonly painted scene in the Book of the Dead is the weighing of the heart in the afterlife, right? And if the heart is found wanting, there's a hideous monster waiting near the scales to devour the soul. If the heart is found honest, then it's suitably rewarded. And there's a sense that the afterlife is run by stricter rules of justice than this imperfect world, which is very different from the Greek afterlife. Again, the Greeks had a very, very sort of bleak and unjust view of the afterlife. It's like some huge, senseless Kafkaesque bureaucracy. Everything's arbitrary and completely insane. I mean, that's their view of the afterlife. So Socrates is much more Egyptian, if you will. Now, another thing is this. He also swears, by the dog, the Egyptian's god, in various places. In the Gorgias, explicitly, he identifies it as the Egyptian's god. Now, the trouble is that the Egyptians didn't treat any dogs as gods, although they did have a jackal-headed god, Anubis, and there were other jackal-headed gods, too. And he does tell Egyptian tales in a number of places, and so it's very clear that Plato and Socrates had a certain respect for the Egyptians. How much they really knew about them is another question. But the Atlantis myth is a myth that's transmitted via the Egyptians. But I think that Socrates is just as willing to be critical and also somewhat cavalier about the transformation of Egyptian stories. Because again, although they're better than Greek myths, they still suffer. Any story about Horus and Set and Osiris is just as horrifying as any story of the Greek gods. So I'd like to just begin our discussion of the Timaeus by pointing to Raphael's School of Athens. And the reason is this. In the School at Athens, the book Timaeus is represented here under Plato's arm. It says Timaeo here, and he's pointing to the heavens, which of course indicates the primarily cosmological meaning of the myth. Now here's Socrates here, and Socrates is counting on his fingers, and I do think it's interesting that the Timaeus begins 1, 2, 3. But where, my dear Timaeus, is the fourth of our guests of yesterday, our hosts of today? And Socrates is counting, and there's 1, 2, 3 fingers and his thumb extended. So I think he's counting, which means at least three of these men are the other figures mentioned in the Timaeus. Now, who are the other three figures? Well, there's Socrates, that's the first, Timaeus, Hermocrates, and Critias. Now, Hermocrates is the famous general from Syracuse who destroyed the Athenian expeditionary force in 415 to 413 BC. He utterly crushed Athens as a power, which led eventually to its defeat in the Peloponnesian War, and really Greece has never recovered since. Here's a figure wearing a helmet, and I'm sure this is meant to be Hermocrates. Now, Critias
is described as a very old man here. And here's an old man wearing a funny hat. So that's got to be Critias. Now, Timaeus is a figure who was respected in his own city, but he's probably pretty much a contemporary of Socrates. Now, frankly, that would mean he would be an adult man and he'd have a beard, if he were, or most of them would. Well, I mean, none of these three actually have beards. But there are several candidates. This fellow who's sort of saying, yoo-hoo over here, this person in the background, and then this young fellow who's looking a little out of it. One of them must be Timaeus. I don't know who, by process of elimination. But anyway, I think it is a representation of the opening of the Timaeus. I think these two figures in the background probably should be discounted, and that this person here, who looks like he's not paying much attention, must be our Timaeus. But he doesn't look like a very formidable or wise figure as he's rendered by Raphael. Hermocrates, Critias, Timaeus, and Socrates.
Let me tell you just a bit about the three major parties of the dialogue, aside from Socrates. We all know Socrates, right? Socrates is a local Athenian philosopher, sort of a bum when you get right down to it. But what about Critias, Timaeus, and Hermocrates? Well, all we know, really, about the historical Timaeus comes from Plato's dialogue. And what is said? Well, first of all, it's said that he is from Locri. Now, Locri was a Greek city-state in southern Italy. The Greek cities of southern Italy were ruled by the Pythagorean sect, or members of the Pythagorean school of philosophy. Pythagoras came from there, and his followers attained political power in many of these cities. Even after Pythagoras himself was driven away, his followers held power. They were philosopher kings, in other words. And Timaeus is described as a philosophic statesman who has held all the important offices in his city. And his account of the cosmos is very much the kind of account you'd expect from the Pythagoreans. So what does that mean? What are the Pythagoreans? Well, Pythagoras, of course, is the inventor of mathematics as a science. Now, before Pythagoras, of course, people counted and measured and did things like that. The word geometry, for instance, literally means earth measurement. And so geometry arose from the practical necessity of surveying land. It was a practical art rather than a science, a speculative kind of science or a theoretical activity. Pythagoras is credited with the transformation of arithmetic and geometry into purely speculative sciences, which he used to give an account of nature. Pythagoras, however, was not primarily a speculative philosopher in the sense that the early Greek natural philosophers were. He was very much a moral philosopher in his primary focus. His mathematical studies were directed towards the practical aim of separating the soul and the body. How can that work? Well, mathematics involves abstracting away from physical things and shapes and appreciating ideal things like numbers. And the idea was that as one becomes more practiced in mathematics, one is more capable of separating soul from body, one's ideas from physical things. And why would anyone want to be able to live in the realm of abstractions and separate and elevate one's soul above the body? Well, the Pythagoreans held this view about the soul and the body. The soul pre-exists the body and survives the body's death. It's immortal. Souls go through cycles of reincarnation. Their original source, though, is somewhere above this world, and that they somehow fall into the clutches of matter and become caught up in the cycles of birth and death and rebirth, which is a source of nothing but suffering. The soul on its own is happy. The soul in matter suffers from desire, attachment. All of these are the sources of suffering. This is very much like Buddhism. In order to release oneself, to liberate oneself from suffering, one has to liberate oneself from desire by practicing asceticism in this life, And so the Pythagoreans were not only mathematicians, they also gave up on sex and they gave up on meat. They were vegetarians. They lived in little communities with one another, and they practiced techniques of meditation and separating the soul from the body, mental discipline, and so forth. And mathematics was one of these mental disciplines. The goal was to, in this life, attain such separation of the soul from the body, such a mastery of the body by the soul, that when death came, the soul and the body could go their separate ways, the soul returning to its source, and the body simply degenerating into muck, but thereby attain liberation from the cycle of birth and rebirth for all time. So it was primarily a moral philosophy of salvation. But they did have this mathematical natural science. And the Discourse of Timaeus is a discourse that makes use of mathematics the way the Pythagoreans did, and so it's very clear that he was a Pythagorean himself. And that many of Plato's works also contain influences of the Pythagoreans. Socrates himself didn't seem to be terribly influenced by these people, but Plato did. And that's one of the differences between the two of them. Now, if Timaeus is from Locri, this allows us to give a very precise date for the dialogue, for this reason. From 429 to 404 BC was the so-called Peloponnesian War, which was a war between all of the Greeks, basically. Athens was the leader of one of the factions and Sparta the other. And the Peloponnesian War lasted for 25 years, and it led to Athens' defeat and destruction as a great power. The war was fought and then stopped and then started up again, and it stopped during 422 to 421 BC, which was the so-called Peace of Nicias, who was a general in Athens. And Nicias had created peace, and it was during this period, 422 to 421 BC, that someone like Timaeus could be expected to be in Athens for this reason. The Locrians were enemies of the Athenians, rather bitter enemies, actually. In 426, they got involved in the war with Athens. In 425 BC, they defeated an Athenian expeditionary force sent against them, which was no mean feat. And in 424 BC, they refused to accept peace. Athens, even though the Athenians had made peace with their enemies in Italy and Sicily. All the other Italian and Sicilian states made peace with Athens in 424, but the Locrians refused. Later in 422, when a general peace was declared, the Locrians made peace as well, and the reason why they made peace was simply this, that they got involved with a war, in another war, between two of their neighboring city-states, and they didn't want to have to worry about Athens. So they concluded peace with Athens as part of this general peace called the Peace of Nicias, which lasted for a year. Now, this is the time when you would expect a Locrian ambassador, a man of high rank, to be in Athens during this period of peace, because before that there was war, and after that there was war. So it had to be 422 to 421 BC. There's a festival that's mentioned at the beginning of the text, a festival to the goddess Athena. And it's not referred to as the Great Festival. Okay? There were two festivals that were celebrated by the Athenians for their goddess. One is called the Greater Pan Athenia, which was celebrated every 4 years. And the other was called the Lesser Pan Athenia, which was celebrated every year that the greater one wasn't celebrated. Now, we know that in 422, there was a Greater Pan Athenia happening. And since it's not mentioned, we would have to infer that the date of this is 421 BC, sometime during the middle of the month of August, which is when this festival was celebrated. So the time and date is 421 BC, mid-August, 421 BC, when this discussion takes place. Now, this also fits in very nicely with what we know about Hermocrates. Socrates makes very clear that Hermocrates is somebody who's known to him only by reputation. He's not known to him in any other way. And Hermocrates was, according to Thucydides, a man second to none in intelligence. He was an extraordinarily intelligent statesman and general. And he had just begun to make an impression on the world. In 424 BC, there was a great Pan-Sicilian Congress at the city of Gela. And at this Congress, Hermocrates spoke about war with Athens, the necessity of fighting the war and how to fight it and so forth. He made his reputation then. He came to be heard about at that time. He hadn't really done anything yet, but he was reputed for his speeches, if not his deeds. He became famous for his deeds only in 415 to 413 BC when he utterly destroyed Athens' expeditionary force to Sicily. Now, there would be no time that he would be welcome in Athens after 415, and because of the necessities of war, he would have to be there after 425 during this period of the Peace of Nicias. And so, again, it makes sense that he would be there in 421 BC. There was a large number of ambassadors and personages traveling from Athens, erstwhile and future enemies, to the city. So we have a date. Now, what about Critias? Critias is an interesting character. And if you'll take out this little chart, the transmission of the Atlantis myth, we'll have reason to come back to this later. But the identity of Critias has been disputed for a long time. And the reason is this. There is a famous character known as Critias the Tyrant, who was a cousin of Plato's mother. Critias the Tyrant, along with Plato's uncle Charmides, were members of the group called the 30 Tyrants, who ruled in Athens for about a year after the defeat of Athens in the Peloponnesian War. And both of them died in 403 BC when the 30 Tyrants were overthrown, and most of them died in the process. The ancient commentators, especially Proclus, who was a 6th century AD Neoplatonist who wrote a commentary in the Timaeus, have identified the Critias here as Critias the Tyrant. Now, this can't be true, though, because of the way that the characters are described. The Greeks had a habit of naming children after their grandparents. And this isn't uncommon even today, right? But the Greeks were especially this way. Generally, the firstborn son would be named after his grandfather on his father's side. If this held true, then Critias had a grandfather named Critias. And if Critias had a grandfather named Critias, then this Critias would be about the right age to be the Critias of the Timaeus. And so it's been speculated, and there is now some independent evidence that has come to light to back this up, that there was another Critias who was a grandfather of Critias the Tyrant. And he would be the perfect person, chronologically, to do this. And so let's just look at this transmission myth tree. The sinking of Atlantis is at the top, okay? This is how the myth comes down. And Critias is the transmission belt. He's the one who tells the story of Atlantis here. Atlantis sinks. There's a 1,000-year-long oral tradition that later is written down, preserved for 8,000 years by the Egyptians. Now, of course, the Egyptians weren't around and writing for 8,000 years, certainly not at the time that Plato was living, and not since. I mean, Egyptian culture wasn't that old, but this is fanciful. A priest at the Egyptian city of Sais told Solon, who was one of the 7 sages of Greece and one of the great founders, in some ways, of the Athenian polity. To see he was a founder didn't mean he started it by any means, but it meant that he was one of the people who founded the form of government that existed at the time, which was a kind of mixture of democracy and oligarchy. Now, Solon was a friend of a fellow known as Dropides II, actually, and he was also a cousin of him, and he was therefore a distant ancestor of Plato himself. Now, Solon went to Sais in Egypt. At the time, Sais was the capital of Egypt until 525 BC when Egypt was conquered by the Persians. But there was a period known as the Saitic Renaissance, during which Egypt had thrown out all of its foreign invaders and dominators and had resurged to a position of great wealth and respect in the world. This lasted about 200 years. And the last pharaoh of this period was Amasis, and he's mentioned in here. And Amasis actually didn't belong to the family, the dynasty that had started the thing. He was an interloper, but that doesn't matter that much, I suppose. But Amasis was a general who became pharaoh during a civil war and was an enormously splendid and powerful political figure, one of the great late Egyptian political leaders. And he managed to keep the Persians out for a very long time, even though they were trying to take over. And shortly after his death, when the throne reverted to one of the members of the family he had overthrown, one Psammeticus III, the Persians finally descended and conquered Egypt. Amasis was a good friend of the Greeks, and he allowed the Greeks to found a city in Egypt, a trading city called Naucratis, which is being excavated now, and it's full of Greek ruins and pottery and things like that. And it was really during this time that the Greeks first came into contact with the Egyptians, and the effects on Greek art were quite apparent. Pre-classical, or so-called archaic Greek sculpture, is very Egyptian in its aesthetic. Later, as the classical period dawned, it became much more naturalistic and free-flowing and less blocky than the Egyptian art. The Egyptians had enormous influence on Greek art, and they were an immensely old civilization at this time. And they were aware of that, and they had an enormous kind of cultural self-confidence. This is why the Saitic priest says, "Oh, you Greeks are just children." They were, relatively speaking. Anyway, the priest of Sais tells the story. He doesn't have time to look it up, he says, but he tells the story of Atlantis. He doesn't, from memory, even though he says there are written records, 8,000-year-old written records. But he tells the story to Solon. Now, Solon tells it to Critias II, who's the grandfather of our Critias in the dialogue, who is related to him, too. And Critias II, when he is a 90-year-old man, which would be about 510 B.C., tells Critias III, when he's a 10-year-old boy, the story of Atlantis. Then Critias III, when he's an old man, and he's clearly an old man in this dialogue, which is 421 B.C., he would be a rather old man if he was born in 520 B.C. But it wasn't unheard of for these Greeks to live very long periods of time. Gorgias, our sophist from the last class, lived 105 or 109 years, sources vary. But Critias III, as a very old man, tells this tale to Socrates and the other people present. And as you'll read in the text, he says that he started telling the story the day before, but he couldn't quite remember it all. And so he went home and he started thinking about it, and he says, "It's remarkable, I forget things that happened just yesterday, but I can remember this as clear as it just happened the day before, even though I only heard this at age 10, which was 90-some years before." And so he says he will tell the whole Atlantis story, but after Timaeus tells his story. So Timaeus tells his big story, and then the Critias begins with Critias relating this tale. Now, all of this detail is extremely important, because it's giving an indication of one of the problems about conventional, ordinary myths. The whole process of transmission. How are we to believe, after all, that a story that happened 9,000 years before was accurately transmitted 1,000 years by means of oral tradition, then was accurately copied and recopied for 8,000 years in a written tradition, and then was accurately related by a priest who was too busy to actually go and look it up, so he was depending on his memory, to Solon. Solon later told this to Critias II. Critias II, when he was 90, told this to his 10-year-old grandson. And his 10-year-old grandson, when he's more than 100, tells this to Socrates, Timaeus, and Hermocrates. It seems very, very unlikely. Right? It seems very unlikely that this could all be done well. And Socrates sticks all this in there for a reason. He wants us to reflect upon the difficulties of memory and the difficulties of oral transmission and written transmission. Then, of course, there are additional problems here, because Socrates, presumably, right, told this story to Plato, And then that story has been transmitted for more than 2,000 years through manuscripts, more than 2,000 years before the printing press came along. It was copied and recopied in manuscript form. And then after the invention of printing in printed form. And then it was translated by Mr. R.G. Bury for us. Okay? So we're forced to reflect upon the difficulties of transmission of myths, in ordinary sense of myths, by this whole framework. But anyway, the identity of Critias here is basically he's just the transmission belt. He's a very old man who heard this from a very old man when he was a very young child, and he is passing this on. And it's apparently not written down any other place, so he's the sole thread, the sole link in the chain of this long story. And so we have to wonder about it. We have to recognize that there is, that memory was trained by the ancient peoples to do this. However, there are certain dramatic details that will throw that into difficulty here, too. The fact is that the story is told to a 10-year-old on a single day. And then the 10-year-old, when he's more than 100, keeps talking about his memory. But he's sure that he remembers it as clear as it was yesterday, even though he can't remember what happened yesterday. And so even with trained memories, we're dealing with somebody who was so young when he heard it that you have to wonder how well trained his memory could have been, and so old when he told it that his memory is already fading. We look at the main characters, Hermocrates, the general, Critias, and Timaeus. We have some indication of who these guys were. We know when it happened, mid-August, 421 BC. And what I'd like to do next time is let's just cover the introductory stuff where everything gets set up, and we can go through this in fairly good detail and just get to know these people. Also, what happens in the introduction is Socrates recounts the stuff that they talked about before. The day before, Socrates was their host at his little hovel, and he told them about an ideal city, which sounds in many ways like the city of the Republic. Now they're at the house of Critias, which was probably a very grand house. And Critias, as it turns out, is playing host to Timaeus and Hermocrates, which would be reasonable. If these are dignitaries, they'd go to the house of a wealthy man to stay. We have yet to talk about the fourth person, the unnamed fourth person who's absent. And there's some speculation about his possible identity. One possible person is Alcibiades. That would fit in with the historical account. Another person who's maybe more plausible in some ways, although historically wouldn't fit, would be Pericles. Warman Welliver is a scholar who's argued that it's Pericles. Of course, Pericles died in 429 BC, so he couldn't have just fallen sick. But the thing is that other Platonic dialogues play fast and loose with chronologies, so we don't necessarily have to be too tied to it here. In any case, we'll talk about the missing fourth and about the Republic tale.